This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Welcome back to an exciting episode of the Doxcast, everybody. It's me, your usual host, Richard Early. I guess I'm minus my usual co-host, Josh Trumbo, so no pronouns or adjectives, not pronouns. Funny adjectives. I'll get there. That's because I don't have Josh. It's a disaster. All right. The reason I don't have Josh is because it's a Magic the Gathering podcast, so Kyle Rehome is here.
Hello, everybody.
And Matt Cerrone is back with us as well.
Hello.
I'm just going to refer to you both as Magic Gurus. Matt is the Magic Guru with a limited speciality. Mm-hmm. And Kyle, you are, I don't know, what's your speciality?
All-around awesomeness.
All-around awesomeness.
Probably standard.
We've got a lot of exciting stuff coming up in Magic the Gathering around Paradox, that's for sure. And we'll be telling you, and have been telling you all about that. But today we are here to talk about the big boy, Guilds of Ravnica. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, first of all, this is the October set. So this is what used to be, like, the fall set. You know, we'd always look forward to this to kick off the year and see what everything was going to be like. And now that happens every 3 months, basically.
Yeah, so. Exactly. All of our sets are big sets. They're all standalones now, unless they decide to change it again. Who knows? But, yeah, we don't have that special moniker of this being, like, the start of the block or anything like that.
I don't think I have the attention span to go back to blocks anyway.
And anymore. So. I think once people get a taste of this with Dominaria and then the Ravnica sets, I don't think people are going to want to go back.
And we're getting a taste right away of what they said, which was if they wanted to stay on a plane for a while or they had a story reason to do it, they still could do it.
Yep.
And so we're getting back-to-back Ravnica sets, and we know there's
back-to-back.
Yep, we know there's a third one that we don't have the name for. We can kind of probably guess where this is going pretty easily. But so the cool thing about that also is that every time a new set releases, draft formats will completely change. And sealed deck, not that we play a lot of sealed anymore, but you'll always have just three packs of new sets, and you won't deal with that like hangover of the last set anymore.
Yeah.
So, Matt, how do you feel about that? Does that excite you, or are you sad because you missed the days of, like, I really like this set, and there are packs of it for 9 months available?
There's always going to be moments like that. Like, people love Dominaria, and then, like, it's always sad to see it closing down to move on to something else. But in general, I think a three-month window to play a format in general is pretty good, and I think that constantly making it new and interesting again over the long haul, 100%, I think people will enjoy it.
Also, the benefit is they went from Dominaria to M19, and now they're going from M19 to Guilds of Ravnica. So there's no way. Like, this is going to be fun compared to...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't want to say anything bad about M19. Well, anyway, so let's talk Guilds of Ravnica. I basically just had my notes to kind of kick off. We always start by talking about the lore. So Kyle's going to do that. We'll talk about it as well and where we think it's headed. But, just as a note, this is the third time now. This is the first time in Magic history we've gone back to the same plane three times.
Yeah.
And so it'll
be... That's not true.
Well, okay, what?
We've been to Dominaria three
That's
times.
That's true. Well,
we kind of count
the beginning of Magic as all Dominaria. So, yeah, there were more than three trips there. But.
Yeah. Also true, but I guess so. Let's say the modern era since Mirrodin, which changed things into the modern era. So it's interesting that they... I would think it would be fascinating from their design side on how they could still keep the plane fresh and still mm-hmm. find things to explore within it. And it does seem like it's so rich, like you could kind of go on and on and on here, right? Like, it's so much lore is established that there's so much to do with cards that there's no, and this set, I think, shows you there's a lot of freshness still.
Kind of interesting, like, we were talking about Dominaria for a sec, too, because, honestly, I'd say modern-day-wise, I think Ravnica just is our Dominaria now. I think it is the place that most players are most familiar with and are most excited about. It's got a lot of depth to it because of the 10 guilds and all that, so it's a place you could probably tap into for a very long time.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, and they can keep coming back and putting different spins on it. I mean, we've had... some guilds have had three different mechanics as we've visited each time, and one guild has had the same mechanic every three times that we visited it. So I mean, they can really do a lot with such a defined space.
The last thing I'll say before we talk about the lore is you also get this anchor where, you know, land isn't always the most popular thing, especially to casual players. They just they like cool creatures and spells and stuff like that. But the shock lands that you get when you go back to Ravnica and they put them in again, it's just they're so fundamentally strong and fair and basic and usable for absolutely every player that getting them back in every, what, I don't know if it's 5 years,
yeah,
4 years.
Yeah, about 5 years or so.
Like, makes a lot of sense. Matt did point one thing about that out as far as, like, modern implications and stuff like that, but in general, just being able to keep those refreshed for players' access is something that's easy to do. So, and
we get our third artwork, so now you've got three different, well, four if you count the expeditions.
Oh my goodness, you could have one of each.
You could have one of each in your deck, so you can pick your favorite that way. Yeah, Shocklands are awesome. Glad to see him come back. I mean, the price tag wasn't horrible, but it was getting to the point where you weren't going to want to really buy $20 lands all the time.
They're also very format defined also, because every time they do the shocks, they bring them all, like, in the span of 6 months, and so that's a lot of mana fixing, one of the best like types outside the fetches they ever do, so it also makes humongous implications to gameplay, even if they look somewhat uninteresting.
Yeah.
From a value point of view, it's going to be, this is going to be the cheapest these have ever been, is my guess, and that's not because they're bad, you know, I just think, like, the third printing here, when Return to Ravnica was the most open set, it was the first set of this even more modern era, and people went bananas opening it, and there's just a lot of cards out there.
Yep.
So, and I do think, I mean, that'll impact people and their interest in the set on that way, and that's why some of these other things they've done in here are really good, because you used to buy packs to get one, you know, like that was the big thing. It's like, oh, I might get a Shockland, right?
Yep, exactly.
You're going to be buying $4 packs, and you're going to see some of these at $4 for a price. So the drive to do that isn't the same, but the ability for players to get four at an affordable price, this is going to be the time to do it if you've been waiting at all to make sure that you get them.
Absolutely.
So, all right, let's talk about what this sets. Why are we back on Ravnica, Kyle?
So we're back on Ravnica because it turns out this is where Bolas' master plan leads to. All the sets leading up to this have been following Nicol Bolas and all his nefarious plans and what he's planning to do, and it turns out Ravnica's the place he wants to do it. So we haven't seen him here yet, but we've got all the characters that have been around Bolas. Vraska is back on Ravnica, and we know that she's working with Bolas. Ral Zarek is kind of his new lackey as well. And we're going to see three more Planeswalkers in the next set that are all part of Bolas' crew. So we get five Planeswalkers across these first two sets, and those are all the ones that are going to turn and help Nicol Bolas in his final fight. And then we can presume that the Gatewatch is going to show up and try to stop him, but we'll have to wait and see in those future sets. As far as Ravnica-specific stuff, the guilds are a lot more in conflict this time around, a lot more fighting against each other and trying to stake their claim. The Dimir are sneaky as always, trying to figure out, you know, their own plan to counteract Nicol Bolas' plan. Just a lot going on, so.
Those sneaky Dimir.
The who?
So yeah, we're headed for the third set. It's kind of easy to probably speculate what it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's going to be, you know, Bolas versus Ravnica, and all the guilds or a certain number of them come together along with the Gatewatch. So
it might finally be sort of our Planeswalker War set.
That's true.
Been thinking about for a while, which would be interesting. Like, because if there's, you know, if there's five Planeswalkers in this set, like, how many Planeswalkers might there be in that
exactly.
set? Like, it's... could they put five Planeswalkers in one set? That would be crazy.
It would be.
I feel like the most likely conclusion of this is the split of five guilds fighting four Bolas and five fighting against him.
It seems likely,
and, it's like taking wild predictions that which five I thought would align with them and all that. So it's,
they've experimented in the past with trying to marry that flavor to... We've tried the story cards in the set, so does this one still have...
We do have story cards in this set, yes.
We've tried mechanically before with pre-releases and things like that to, even going back to Mirrodin and Besiege, to have you pick a side or to
choose your faction.
Yep. So I wonder if they've researched that and have a you know, more concrete way to make that matter, like in the pre-releases for whatever the third set
we'll
is.
We'll have to wait and see for sure.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm just kind of excited about the potential, like, and speculating about, like, Planeswalker War, we've been waiting for a long time. So,
absolutely,
Matt, anything here, or should we go on to the Planeswalkers?
No, I think we're good.
Cool. So, all right, as always, we like to kick off card reviews with the Planeswalkers, because, I mean, who doesn't like new Planeswalkers? And like Kyle said, you know, there are going to be five total between these two sets, so one of the sets had to get two, and this is it.
Yep.
So, go ahead. Both of you take a turn, and Kyle, you go first.
All right. I'm going to talk about Vraska, Golgari Queen. So this is a 4 loyalty Planeswalker for 2 black green. Her first ability is a +2, which lets you sacrifice a permanent. If you do, you gain 1 life and draw a card. -3, you destroy a target non-land permanent with converted mana cost 3 or less. And at -9, you get an emblem with whenever a creature you control deals combat damage to a player, that player loses the game.
the minus I really like. I don't know why.
I love this emblem as well. It's just all of my creatures are now have player death touch. You better block them.
I know ultimates are usually pretty pointless back because they're always I win the game somehow. Yeah. But I actually think this one's interesting. I don't know why.
So. Vraska's ultimates traditionally have been pretty awesome. I've enjoyed Vraska's ultimates.
We've had, set them to 1, create 3 assassins that have the player death touch. So.
Yeah, I love Vraska's ultimates.
Yeah, and what do you think of
this card? Is just exactly what you want in black green. It's got incremental value, it's got some removal, and it's eventually going to win the game if it sits out there long enough.
Yep.
I think you're going to have to be able to build your deck a little bit to take advantage of sacrificing permanents, because I don't think just sacrificing a permanent every turn for 1 life on 1 card is quite good enough. But, if you're late in the game with 10 lands on the battlefield, you can play this Planeswalker, sacrifice a permanent, draw a card, and you still get advantage out of it. So,
Matt, I bet they played around with that. I bet 2 damage, 2 life, or 2 cards, things like that. And they just, I don't know why they decided on this one.
But. I'm thankful that they actually put the word May on the plus.
Yes,
honestly,
that's true.
Because she's a weird one this time. Her plus in a lot of board states is effectively non-existent.
Yeah, you don't want to turn 4, slam this down, and sacrifice one of your lands.
Yeah, a tempo loss on the control deck or a aggro deck alike, unless you're sacking to gain advantage off something else, is sketchy territory a lot of times. So it's a weird plus, but I'm glad they added May to it.
Yep.
What do you think of this Vraska, Matt?
I love Vraska. I've loved all 3 Vraskas they've ever done. This is, I believe, the cheapest one they've ever made, right? Because the first one was 5, the second one was 6, right? And
yep,
she's 4. So as you bring them down, you bring down their power caliber level on average from mana cost. So still cool. I love the Golgari Selesnya piece of the color pie. So it's tough for me to ever not like these types of
cards. I realized after I said I was talking about Vraska, I took the one that you actually wanted to talk about.
That's right.
So I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I didn't think of that either. So. And probably what happens is slam her down, use that +2, kill 2 things. That's the most likely scenario.
Her minus is effectively Abrupt Decay, and Abrupt Decay was never bad before, and it does exactly what it needs to for the 4 converted cost. It's trumps all the things that were smaller than her that showed up, so she can maintain the board state relatively cleanly, probably out of her colors.
I think this is a good card. It's not going to be format defining, but it is a solid card.
Well, not every Planeswalker has to be or should be, but
that's right.
That's the interesting thing after you have 3 versions of a Planeswalker is what role are you looking to create with the new one, and to keep the other ones. You don't want to obsolete other ones. You don't want to, but you don't want this one to be unplayable. It's got to be fairly challenging at 25 years into this game, and how many years of Planeswalkers?
Yeah,
they
must have.
They must have went through a redesign of her at some point, because the life gain part of out of her sac effect doesn't match up with anything really going on with that. So I bet that was something else. Maybe that was a life lost in a draw card or something. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
To your opponent, but I think they must have played around with that a little bit.
Sure, Matt, give us the other Planeswalker.
Sure, we got Mr. Rao. Rao is it Viceroy? He's 5 mana, blue, red, 3, 5 loyalty, so the loyalty counts are still holding up there. +1, look at the top 2 cards of your library, put one of them in your hand, they're into your graveyard. -3 to deal damage to a creature equal to the number of instant sorceries you have in exile and in your graveyard. And -8... for all of your instants and sorceries to basically deal 4 damage and let you draw 2 cards whenever you cast them.
Yep. That's good.
I like that ultimate a lot more than Vraska, obviously Vraska's is much, like, it's going to win you the game more.
Yeah. But I just think Vraska's is funny. Like, yeah. I like it in a not, like, powerful, I don't know. I just
It's impossible for that plus to ever be bad. Impossible. It's a slightly better Jace draw card effect. Yep. Like, I mean, it's never going to be bad, ever. The minus... that's a lot of hoops to jump through. I mean, if you're 5 mana loyalty, usually a minus is almost guaranteed you're blowing something up. And this thing actually may do nothing, depending on the situation in the game. So,
well, it feels very set dependent.
It's weird.
Like, it really, like this whole set, as we'll discuss, really works around your graveyard, right? And and so this card just feels like it belongs in Guilds of Ravnica, but we'll see what kind of life it gets once it's not just in Guilds of Ravnica.
Yeah, exactly. So. I mean, I think the hardest thing Rawl has going for him is that you just would rather play Teferi. Like, Teferi draws a card, Teferi gets rid of a permanent, and Teferi has an emblem that wins the game. Like,
sure.
I think until Teferi rotates out of Standard, Rawl might not see play, but...
And, I mean, he's even in competition with, there's some, one of the mechanics out of exactly the Izzet color is already fighting for those in sorceries. So, that's one of the reasons that they've added the exile, like, wording to a lot of these types of cards. They're floating around, and there's multiple cards in the set that have that exile word on it.
Yep.
That's why, is that they're not trying to penalize the mechanic.
No, it's a really creative, and I'm glad they took the risk of doing that, because that would have just been such a feel bad. It's like, well, I want to keep a sorcery or instant in my graveyard, but I also want to use the ability that's printed on the card and jumpstart it, and like that that would just not be fun for anybody. So
I have like early onset Alzheimer's, I feel like, but okay, so like there was the old red blue flashback deck with the enchantment and whatnot. Like, this feels like it fits in that deck. If you guys
Burning Vengeance?
Burning Vengeance. Like, sure. Is a deck like that around in any format, or is that just like those days are long gone? So.
Probably not. I mean, that was a limited archetype. I don't think it really made it into Constructed, but it could be some. I mean, people are. Blue Red Spells is going to be on people's radar because we're in a set that has an amazing Blue Red Spells sub theme. It's just a matter of if it can, you know, pull through and Constructed.
Sure. So, okay, those are your Planeswalkers. We'll have three more in the next set that all work together. So let's get to those mechanics so that we can talk about what this set is like and what we're likely going to see when we're playing it. So should we start with the returns? Should we start with the Selesnya then and just work our way forward?
Yeah, for sure. So Selesnya, as we
mentioned. Talk about
Selesnya.
Selesnya, this is really easy. You all, if you ever played Magic the Gathering at all in like the past, like literal any amount of time, Convoke is coming back. I believe it's the third time they've done it.
Fourth time. It was in a core set.
And they've stated that the mechanics seems clean. I think it's pretty intuitive. I think that people understand it. There's never any real confusion about it.
Yep.
And it's one of my favorite mechanics they made. So I'm glad that they keep reusing it.
The biggest change...
For anybody that's unfamiliar with the mechanic, Convoke like is just a cost reduction mechanic. So, I mean, if something costs 4 mana, it's mana cost... You can tap creatures to help pay for the mana cost of a spell to reduce it all the way down to it. You can make it free if you have enough creatures out to cover the cost.
And being in white green, it usually comes in the colors that produce a lot of tokens or small creatures.
Traditionally,
I don't know if you want to briefly talk about the status of that in this set.
Kyle, I mean, it's definitely there in green and green, white, and Selesnya. You're going to see cards that make multiple tokens. The cool thing that they did with Convoke in this set is they actually made cards that care about being used for Convoke, or that will buff the cards that you use to Convoke the spell that you're casting. So, for example, there's a Luxodon Restorer. It's an elephant of some sort. It's 5 mana, has Convoke. And when it comes into play, you put a +1/+1 counter on each creature that you used to Convoke it. So, like, you could tap 5 creatures, give them all a counter, and you have this giant elephant now as well. So,
okay, sweet.
Yeah, they've got
a
couple.
The only thing I want to know is if you can overpay for it.
You cannot.
And you, all right. I didn't think
you
so.
You cannot.
Yeah. Yeah, so again, Convoke is
Anyway, they definitely have toned down the token generation in this time around, at least in this particular set, which makes sense. Convoke sometimes, occasionally when they do it, gets a little bit too powerful if they have a little bit too much in it. So the number of token generators is definitely down, no doubt, but they have compensated for that fact by making sure that some cards have benefits from being tapped.
So is Convoke the only mechanic? Well, let's go to Golgari.
Sure.
Let's just move along that way.
Yeah.
So, because I think all the other ones are thematic to what the set I think is trying to do. Convoke is kind
of
not.
But. No, I mean Convoke is like I said they built a lot of cards that care about Convoke and play well with it. So I don't think it's
sure.
not thematic.
Well, okay, I'll elaborate on my thought. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let's do Golgari.
So Golgari, their mechanic this time around is called Undergrowth. So this is an ability keyword, meaning that it doesn't have direct impact, but what it does is it cares about the number of creature cards in your graveyard. So I'll give you an example card. This is Azoni Thousand-Eyed. This is one of our leaders of the Golgari Guild. He costs 2 black, green, and he has an ability, Undergrowth, which is just a reminder to say, when Azoni Thousand-Eyed enters the battlefield, create a 1/1 black and green insect creature token for each creature card in your graveyard. Then it also has the ability to play black and green, sacrifice another creature, gain a life and draw a card, and then it's a 2/3 body. So yeah, Undergrowth can do a variety of different things. It's just a reminder keyword to say, hey, this cares about the number of creature cards in your graveyard.
Yeah, I mean, well, we've had a number of graveyard mechanics like that, where things that matter in your graveyard. So from Threshold to something else, or is Threshold the only?
Yeah, they had one a couple core sets ago as well.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on the name right now, but yes. Like, yeah, sometimes they play the Graveyard Matters game, definitely.
Much like, I guess the point is, much like Convoke, it's just very straightforward. You know, it's simple, right? So
yes. Well, and it's very flexible. Like I said, it can do a number of things. Like, you just think of something in the game and then tack on, hey, the number of creatures in your graveyard cares. Like, it's a fun ability, and it plays really well with some of the other stuff in the set too.
I remember, like, with Shards of Alara, there were a lot of things like this where they're just sort of like static. They weren't necessarily activated or things like that,
right.
You know, and that's what this a lot of these
you had, like, yeah, domain where it cared about, like, the number of basic land types you had, or
or size of creature. Or,
I didn't read through every single Undergrowth effect, but I tried to. So I may be off, but I think they basically all act as Enter the Battlefield style effects. I don't know if basically any of them have ongoing effects, really. That might be by design, maybe, because then it gets confusing as players have to start remembering that the creature counts are changing and all that. So that it's similar to Convoke, at least when it happens, it's done, and they don't have to think about it later.
Yes, exactly.
And you get something for sure, so there's never a feel bad.
Absolutely.
Well, you could have zero, in which case
zero.
Yeah. It's definitely a mechanic that, unsurprisingly, it's much better later, or if you're abusing shoving stuff into your graveyard. Otherwise, I mean, some of the effects are pretty minor, but then they get pretty gross when suddenly you have 7 creatures in your graveyard.
Yeah, and all I was getting at with Convoke is that the other 4 mechanics we're going to talk about all interact with graveyard stuff in some way. So who's next?
No. Boros doesn't.
Oh, you're right. Boros doesn't.
Yeah. Come on, Rich.
All right. Well, let's keep the color. Let's keep going. Let's go to Dimir so we keep a black and then a blue.
Sure.
I love this
movie. Yeah. Dimir has... very likely the strongest mechanic, like, out of the set. It is similar to, it's called Travail. It's similar to Scry. The only difference is you're exactly scrying, except instead of putting the cards on the bottom of your library, you're instead putting the cards that you don't want on top of your deck into your graveyard instead. So if a card reads Travail 3, look at your top 3 cards, choose whichever ones you want to go back on top, and dump the rest into your graveyard. Unsurprisingly, like mechanics like that, it would make an effect like Undergrowth much better, where you get to enable it ahead of time.
Yeah, this is one of the 3 mechanics that care or can help you fuel your graveyard or care about things going into the graveyard. So, I mean, it doesn't matter if we've got graveyard stuff going on in the set. Like, this is just a good mechanic. Like, Scry is just good. Surveil is, in most scenarios, better because, like, you just if
well, put, when
you
putting it on the bottom of your deck almost never does anything.
Yes, exactly.
Putting a card in your graveyard more frequently does something. Yep. Or could. So yeah, I mean it's just strictly
there's so many ways that this thing is infinitely superior to Scry. It's insane. When I read it and I had to reread it for the first time, I am honestly surprised that they put something like this again. It's fundamentally more powerful than Scry, and that's scary.
Well, here's where it's a living game, right? Because they you know, Scry's always been good, right? And so someone along the way evolved the idea, right?
Yep,
now
exactly.
Here we are. So
the other cool thing
they probably had it for a while and wanted to make sure they saved it for a set where the graveyard mattered again, or whatever.
Yeah, so. The other cool thing to note about Surveil is there are a lot of cards in the set that care about you surveilling. So you'll see cards that get a bonus effect every time you surveil, which is just awesome on a mechanic that's already just pure value.
Yeah, and there's a well, we'll talk about my favorite. I think my favorite card in the set is the blue instant. So
sure.
I don't know if it's the best card, but I just like that card a lot. So
yeah.
So blue gets us nowhere now, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Apparently, I hate Is It, so.
Yeah, so Is It's mechanic is cares about spells, specifically spells in your graveyard. It is called Jumpstart. So this is you'll see this on instants and sorceries, and it says you may cast this card from your graveyard by discarding a card in addition to paying its other costs, then exile this card. So an example is Beacon Bolt, which is a sorcery that costs one blue red. And it deals damage to target creature equal to the total number of instants and sorcery cards you own in exile and in your graveyard. And then it has Jumpstart. So it's a removal spell that on the front side, you can cast it twice in the same turn, which is probably the best part about it. Like if you have three instants and sorceries in your graveyard, you can cast this twice using it and then another card for the Jumpstart cost and deal 6 damage to a creature, or you can use it once early and then let it build up and use it again later on. So Jumpstart, again, it's just another value mechanic. Like, the cards with Jumpstart on them are fairly reasonable on their own, and the fact that later on you can cash in a land or a card that's not working for you to recast your good spells in your graveyard is just good.
My first reaction, and Matt and I think talked about this, was, wow, it's a way worse flashback. But that's not looking at what the set is doing again. Right?
Exactly.
And also, the uniqueness of it, it's another way to put a card in a graveyard. Mm-hmm. Which is all what the set is doing in most of these colors.
Yep.
And it also keeps alive that idea of fueling the number of instants or sorceries or creatures in the graveyard by giving you another way to do that. So you just really can't compare it to flashback. It's just not totally fair. It's not as good a mechanic as flashback, but it's what is it doing in this set and therefore in the standard environment that it's in.
I can definitely appreciate that. I mean, like, flashback is pretty powerful.
Yes.
And I mean, like, so you can tell that they have costed these things appropriately to the point where realistically they can never be overly busted, not very frequently by themselves, but I do appreciate them always still allowing you to be able to ditch anything in your hand, including land. So similar to Surveil, it gives you opportunities to get past cards that you didn't want to draw out of your deck anyway, or that you had to draw and they're in your hand. And so, you have those extra lands sitting around, you get to actually do something with them instead of rolling your eyes and I've drawn my 12th land, at least my land doing something.
It's really clever, too, because, your options would have been, if you thought Flashback was too powerful, your option would be to bring back Flashback and just have everything cost even more, like add a colorless or two to every Flashback cost or whatever. And, I mean, that would have disappointed players anyway. So instead, they fixed it in a way that actually just feeds on itself and feeds into, I think, a lot of what the set does.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's solid. I'm not in love with it. I think playing limited with it, and again, it depends on how standard develops, right? It could be strong. It's like the Planeswalker. What will it do when it's not just in this set? Like,
right.
I mean, but I don't know. Maybe we don't. I mean, maybe that doesn't matter. Like, is it fun now? So
Now they were smart enough to make sure that Jumpstart is part of the color pie, like involving Surveil, and so you could dump your Jumpstart card into your graveyard and then Jumpstart it, and that. So finding ways to creatively draw two cards, kind of for your turn.
Yep. And so the last one then, red, leads us into Boros.
Yes, and Boros. Boros has a relatively straight, like, well, Boros always has a attack mechanic, I believe, each time they've done it. This time around, it's called Mentor. Mentor is whenever the creature that has Mentor on it attacks, it can give another creature that's also attacking that's smaller than it a +1/+1 counter permanently. So I think last time around we had Battalion, right?
Yep.
So it's probably not as good as like a Battalion type of effect, because eventually the Mentor won't do anything given enough time.
Yep.
But it fits with the style of Boros. Boros wants to be attacking. This thing makes sure that you keep on smashing.
And there's some decent Mentor guys where you slam them and attack with them, and they're going to do stuff, so.
And I think Mentor on the surface doesn't look that exciting, but I'm looking forward to see how it plays in this set, because there are a lot of, like, really interesting creatures that, like, once you get a counter on them from Mentor, like, kind of start to be a little scary. You know, you've got a number of, like, 1/3 flyers that if you put an extra Mentor counter on them or two counters on them, that's great. One of the Mentor cards that I wanted to highlight is Boros Challenger. It's a red and a white for a 2/3. It has Mentor, but then it has a built-in ability to pay 2 red and a white to give it +1/+1 until end of turn. So it's something that scales into the late game, that once all your dudes have been mentored up enough, you can pump some mana into this guy, make him a little bit bigger, and now he can mentor again on those creatures that might have reached their knowledge limit already.
Yeah, they were very sneaky about this. Mechanic on the surface looks very, very bland and pretty straightforward, but I mean, even something like there's a 1/1 flying lifelinker for one.
Yep.
Doesn't look very scary at all. Suddenly it's got a 1 or 2 +1 counters, and that thing is unbeatable.
Yep.
So, I mean, even if you're chucking your Mentor into attacks with something that dies, if you bulked up something else that was out of the way, you might never be able to beat that other thing.
Yep.
So I think these mechanics overall are easy to play, they're easy to understand, and they each do and serve a pretty cool role in this set. I think, you know, setting up to give us a good environment. So the rest of this thing is going to be basically going through the cards we really like, and that'll help us develop the set as well as we talk about it.
We do have two minor, like, returning things that come along with Ravnica each time. They're
sure.
Present again. Like, they have hybrid mana that they returned again,
sure.
Which allows for flexibility of casting something for, like a white or a red. And they brought back split cards. So sticking with the theme of those two things in each Ravnica era they've drifted into.
Sure. I was just going to housekeep real quick. So this episode will air on Monday morning, the September 24th. And the pre-release is this coming week. So the full spoiler's out. We won't have time to touch every card in it. We're just going to do, like, our favorite cards for the last, like, half hour of this podcast now. So be ready for the pre-release. Things that are different at the pre-release this time. The first thing, it isn't different, but it's different if you haven't played in a Ravnica pre-release before. You can choose the guild that you're most interested in when you come to the pre-release. So you'll get a pre-release deck box like you've been getting. It'll have 6 total boosters in it. 5 of them will be Guilds of Ravnica. One of them will be a seeded pack that will have mainly cards from the guild that you prefer to play. So hopefully then everybody gets this cool experience of, like, I really like Selesnya, but you open 6 straight packs and you can't build a Selesnya deck.
Right.
So, or even kind of, like, worse than that, it's they can't really build a Selesnya deck, but because they like it, they try to build it anyway, and now their pre-release experience is crappy.
Exactly.
Right? So, yeah, so, I mean, I think that's a sweet choice always.
Yeah, I mean, it you know, for the people who really want that highly competitive environment, unfortunately, you don't get that here because you do have some control over what colors you're going to play. But, I mean, it's the pre-release. You have your favorite guilds. You want to play Dimir, get a Dimir pre-release kit. You're going to have at least one pack that has all, you know, blue and black cards in it. And then that's basically a deck right there. Like, those are mostly going to be playable. All you need is, you know, a couple more from your other packs and you're good to go.
Yep.
It just takes away that feel-bad factor. And, you know, it's just one weekend of events. Let's enjoy the set, play the guilds we want, and then, you know, sign up for some other sealed deck events later where you play the gauntlet and see what guild you end up in.
Yeah, and Matt, I mean, sealed is rare enough now where, like, you know, before Sealed was a little more pivotal in the competitive scene, and ironically, we have our biggest competitive Sealed deck the next weekend, but, you know, just coming and having fun, I think, is great, and I know that probably, I know at least back in the day, you weren't always the biggest fan of that, and I totally understand that, but the last thing I was just going to set up for you was the usual problem is existing again of the store gets an allocation of 20% of its total being any guild. So as people choose, that's the only potential problem over the weekend as we've run into over the
years. Yeah, I love the idea of them letting people play what they want to play. Like, that's spectacular. It's just that once in a while when, you know, half of everybody really loves playing the same thing, mm-hmm. it makes it a little bit difficult on the back end to make sure that you're still allowing everybody to do what they do.
Well, there will always be
I appreciate
people,
them continuously trying to work with it.
Yep. There'll always be those couple of people coming Sunday night, and that's their first pre-release of the weekend, and they wanted to play Selesnya and Dimir, and we might be out of them because we can't you know, control that part
yep.
of it. So, but anyway, if you want to, so the thing about that, if you're listening to this online, you have multiple options this time around to pre-register, as well as pre-ordering product. But the pre-registration is all available online at www.paradoxcnc.com. I'll make sure the link is here with the podcast. But you can just use PayPal to buy. And it's the first time we've done it that way. You know, we'll probably evolve the process as we go along. But we're going to use PayPal. We'll leave it be PayPal a few times around just to kind of like gauge people's usage, right?
Yep.
And see what's going on with it before we decide what to invest in developing that further. But it's great. I mean, it's simple. It's just, you know, you're sitting at home now, you can click on a button and you get all signed up. So just make sure you're aware of that this time. We'll be building awareness this time around. And then we also have our normal pre-registration forms. We just ask you at the counter, like, what guild it is you're trying to play. So, there you go. If you like the DoxCast, it airs every Monday morning along with this one, so there's always content every week. So, let's talk about cards from Guilds of Ravnica. We're going to toss this back and forth between Kyle and Matt, picking out cards they like, and we'll discuss some, and we'll move on quickly from others, and there you go. So, who wants to go first? You want to flip a coin?
I think Rich wants to do the first card because he alluded to it earlier.
Ooh,
so let's
true.
Talk about Mission Briefing.
Yeah, Mission Briefing is, without finding it, I think I can do it, but it's blue and instant.
Yep.
And it has Surveil 2, which is pretty awesome. But it basically, does it give it straight flash? It lets you replay a card from your graveyard, an instant or sorcery, right?
Yep.
It's flat out, it's Snapcaster as an instant, but with Surveil too. Like, I mean, it's a one-shot card, so it's not as good as, like, Snapcaster, where you can use it all the time. Mm-hmm. But I love Surveil, and I just think this card does a lot. I think this card is just juice all the way through, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'd almost consider playing an instant that was blue-blue Surveil to, and on top of it, I get to play a card, an instant or sorcery, out of my graveyard anyway. And so I'm adding two blue to the cost of doing whatever that was,
yeah.
Plus I'm surveilling too. And this card's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a really fun card. I mean, being able to get back the best removal spell in your graveyard is great, and then you're just, like, making sure your next draw is also set up, or, like, if you're really desperate, maybe you just go digging for that one card and, you know, flip over the top two cards of your deck, and maybe it's there, maybe it's not. I mean, it has some fun tension to it as well.
I will grant you this is a utility spell, but, like, it's going to, you know, it's either going to replace itself or maybe more than that, and or fuel your graveyard, and or replay that spell you needed to play. Like, that is a loaded spell for blue-blue. It just does a ton of stuff.
There's also a very humorous thing that happens with this card, given enough time. If this goes into a control shell, which, based on the concept that it's basically a flashback thing, is probably where it belongs. Eventually, you start mission briefing your mission briefings.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And so eventually, you're like, yeah, guess what? Surveil 2 is actually Surveil 6 now.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. This card's great.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. That's for sure. I do like that one.
All right, Kyle, then you're up.
All right. Let's talk about Gruesome Menagerie. This is a 3BB for a sorcery. You get to choose a creature card with a converted mana cost 1 in your graveyard, then do the same for creature cards with converted mana cost 2 and 3, return those cards to the battlefield. So you get 3 creatures back. Granted, they have to be somewhat small creatures, but you can build your deck to make sure that that's, like, a good utility. And then, yeah, just go to town. I love the value of this card. There are going to be combos where, I just have the 3 creatures that I need to combo out. I think Kitchen Finks, whatever the vizier that stops counters, and Viscera Seer. I mean, that's a 1, 2, and a 3. there's your combo right there. So maybe that's a thing. I mean, who knows? But I love the value of this card, and I look forward to playing it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a 5-mana spell returning 6 mana worth of value. So yep. you get an upgrade. And given that it's in the color that also has Surveil, there's free opportunities where you're dumping the stuff in, so you're cheating the stuff into play to set itself up, too.
Yeah,
the card's great. Or very solid. Matthew?
Humorously enough, that was one of the cards that was on my list, so I'm going to read the card that I think is maybe the most abusive possibly that you can utilize with that card. It's like there is a single green green creature that's a 1/1 called Pelt Collector that whenever another creature you control enters the battlefield or dies, you put a +1/+1 counter on as long as it's smaller than it.
I did not think of that.
And if it ever has at least 3+1 counters on it, it also gains trample. So given that your 2-drop and likely your 3-drop will both be bigger than it, means that it enters the battlefield actually as a 3-3 alongside your two big abusive guys.
There is in the
Selesnya Golgari shell like of the game, and admittedly both the colors involving green are supposed to be more powerful green cards. There is some pretty disgusting interactions in the creature portion of the game going on here.
Yeah,
you pointed out to me before we started that there's less token generation this time around, but there are more of this sort of thing going on, right?
Yeah, there's some like times around when we're like on these planes, like there's a lot more token stuff there. It looks like they toned it down some, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Convoke, like I said, is overly powerful, so
yeah,
it's understandable.
One thing I noted too is the tokens are really unique on this set. The two biggest, the two main ones that you see are 1/1 soldiers with lifelink, and then 2/2 green and white elf creature tokens. Like, I don't think we've seen those tokens used in previous sets at all, but those are
are the main ones. They actually forewent their knights that they, I think, they usually have.
Yeah, we've been seeing a lot of knights, and now we get these green and white elves, which are cool because they're green and white, so they can help convoke either of your, you know, convoke colors.
Unfortunately, I think some of that might be unfortunate balancing they have to do to make sure that a creature type also doesn't get crazy out of
control.
Yes,
that's also true. We did just come out of Ixalan where we've got some tribal themes, so they had to be really careful. Interestingly as well, we also see a decent amount of like knights, and knights were big in Dominaria. We've got some vampires as well. No dinosaurs or merfolk or pirates though, so we'll see if Ixalan still is able to make a splash or not.
There's one more interesting Surveil guy. Well, there's quite a few, but there's a like kind of a mini Gristle Brand guy.
If
someone else wants to read him, but that would be another card I would pick out.
Sure. I'm assuming you're talking about Doom Whisperer.
Right? That sounds good, right. Yep.
Yeah, it's an oversized demon for cost. Like, so it's 6/6 for black 3.
Yep, that's it.
Flying, trample, pay 2 life, Surveil 2.
Yeah, it just allows for incremental use and is a good body.
Yeah, it's a 6/6 for 5 mana. Like, it's already great for what you want. And then, you know, if it's about to die or you need to make sure that your next draw is good, you just pay a few extra life and check out the top of your deck. This card is very good.
Yeah, I think cards like this traditionally end up being mega hit or miss cards, but the scary part, and we were discussing this just before we started, is if a correct type of control shell exists in a format like this, you have the ability to have this thing come down with you having north of 20 life, 20 to 30 life, and the moment they go for killing it, you just pay 10, 12 life, and you actually just dump a massive portion of your deck into your graveyard, fueling whichever effects you're doing, while at the same time finding exactly the two cards you needed to make sure you were going to keep winning.
Yep.
Like, that's pretty scary.
Yep, I thought he was really good. All right, Kyler, you're up.
All right, I'm going to talk about my favorite card in the set and the card that I really want to break and abuse somehow. It's called Runaway Steamkin. So this is a 1 red and 1 colorless or generic mana for a 1/1. But whenever you cast a red spell, if Runaway Steamkin has fewer than 3+1/+1 counters on it, put a +1/+1 counter on him. Then you can remove 3+1/+1 counters from Runaway Steamkin to add RRR to your mana pool. So, I mean, dream scenario, you're just casting a bunch of cantripping red spells, like red spell, red spell, red spell. get three mana, just dig through your deck. I don't know what happens after that, but something's got to be sweet. And if you start getting two of these guys out there and, like, you're making, you know, essentially two mana per red spell that you cast, I don't know. It just has a lot of potential, and I really want to make it work.
You can tell that they decided to be conservative with a card like this, because a card like this, they probably could have put it one mana if they wanted to really push on it. So that means that they're probably a little scared that it might get actually out of control.
Right, yeah. Or, like, let it get any number of counters on it or something. Like, that would probably be way too good, but...
I can absolutely see this as a favorite for people.
Yes.
Because it's just... It's totally unique and fun.
Yes.
So... Matthew?
Let's see here. I think we haven't hit a white card, so let's do a white guy. They did... What's this thing called again? They made another Oblivion Ring style card, which they do traditionally almost every time around. So this time around, it's 4 mana, lets you exile like a non-land permanent until it leaves the battlefield, but they added Convoke to it this time, which is an interesting play on it, because usually effects like this mostly end up in control shells, and adding Convoke to it gives it a lot more flexibility to maybe end up in more aggressive decks as well. So mm-hmm. I think that is a pretty interesting take on an effect that we see like a lot of.
Yeah, a deck that wants to operate on like 2 to 3 mana that might not be able to afford this effect can now, like, you know, give up a creature for a turn to get rid of that one thing that's stopping their assault, like Lyra, Dawnbringer, whatever it may be, get rid of it, and then, you know, keep on attacking.
I had a guy, I don't know why this makes me think of this, but I had a guy come in the other day, and I was asking him about, you know, are you ready for the pre-release? Well, and he said, oh, well, that says really kind of for Commander players, right? and it was like a weird comment. It was like, I mean, no, like, it's the next set release. Like, I don't know what you mean. He's like, oh, it's all gold, so it's going to be all Commander-y and stuff. So,
I mean, there's definitely some hot Commander cards
in
there, but...
I don't know why that card made me think of this guy.
Yeah, especially and then, a mono-white card.
That... Yeah, it just popped into my head.
You're crazy, Rich.
I'm ADHD, so there you go. So. All right, Kyle, you're up.
Okay, I'm going to talk about...
I didn't have a card, so I just wanted to add flavor.
That's fine, okay. I'm going to talk about a green card that's kind of an interesting spin on Hexproof that we've been seeing. So this is Nullhide Ferox. It is a 6/6 for 2 green, and it has Hexproof. That's fine, right? Like, let's just leave it at that. What else do we need to do? He's got a little bit of downside. He does say that you can't cast non-creature spells. So, yeah, that's pretty significant. He also has an ability where, for 2 mana, Nullhide Ferox loses all abilities until end of turn. Any player may activate this ability. I guess at that point, like, that's a really interesting card, because it's... If you have to play non-creature spells, you can hope that, you know, you can put your shields down, activate that ability, and then play your non-creature spell. Specifically, like, typically with Hexproof creatures, it's really sweet to put auras on them and make it so that they get even bigger, and then your opponent can't kill them. So it's an interesting, like, kind of cat-and-mouse game, but it also gives your opponent the ability to kill it if they need to. They just have to pay a little bit of extra mana. And sometimes that's going to be relevant, and sometimes it's not going to matter. You know, it's a control deck. Oh, I can spare 2 extra mana to kill this creature.
Yeah, this card is a tough cookie to crack. Like, they play around with Hexproof a lot. Hexproof is one of the most abusive things they've ever added to the game in modern-day Magic. And they keep trying to find ways to keep around the game where it can still be fair. And this is, like... Probably one of the closest versions I've seen, like, of the type of thing. It's a card that may be absolutely incredible or maybe do nothing. It doesn't have trample, so
right. Yep.
It can be chumped for days until they set themselves up to be able to knock it out of the park. It's you can't cast non-creature spells. Not so much of a drawback. That's traditionally a card that probably would be in a deck that is creature-oriented anyway. But you can make it not have the effect yourself if you'd like to cast your own non-creature spell, too. And then it does have one last effect on it, where if your opponent makes you discard from your hand, you just get to put it right into play.
Yes. Yeah. So just in case. It wasn't quite good enough, give that little upside.
He is one of the big band of, like, I believe that there is 6 to 8 very good creatures in this set, personally, and he's, like, one of those guys that may or may not be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I worry that this guy doesn't, ultimately live up to what the people who want to play this type of card want it to be, just because they don't take into account enough, like, their opponent's abilities to do stuff.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, like, he's obviously really cool, you know, yes. But that's, I don't know, we'll see.
It's costed right where Wizards needs him to be costed. He costs 4 without acceleration, meaning that on average, your opponent would be laying their 4th land drop, paying 2 to remove it, paying the 2 to kill it.
Yep.
So they made sure that your opponent most of the time can't get just, like, strangled by it.
Granted, we do have Land of War Elves in the set, or in the previous set, so that can always accelerate things out.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Get this guy
very
on
much
turn
so.
3.
All right, Matt, you're up.
Okay. This is a weird card, like, in that I really don't know if it's gonna be good or not, but I'm always intrigued when they keep trying things. So there is a guy called Dream Eater out of blue. He's blue 4 for a 4/3 creature. But it has a million things going on. It has flying, fine. It has flash, all the better. It surveils 4 and comes into play. That's disgusting. It might be the biggest surveil count in the set, I believe. And it bounces a non-land permanent, like, when it comes into play. Its size is a little awkwardly small, but that's a lot of action going on a card. And so I could see a possibility of a card like this maybe being better than it looks like at a glance.
Yeah, I mean, 4 power flying is still a plenty fine clock. And you get to, you know, deal with a troublesome permanent on the board to buy you some time. I definitely could see this scene play. Like, it's right on the edge. It just depends upon if that body is quite good enough or
not. It's a very clean reanimation style target. And in the sets and the formats where you have unsummoned type of effects, which are very cheap, it also gives you the ability to just rebounce it and resurveil 4. And that keeps the fuel going for, like, a lot of slower decks.
We see a lot of blue guys with, in the sets that are like this, and do they usually pan out, you know?
Usually, no. There's high competition because, you know, like, blue is by definition one of the control colors. Therefore, if it's one of the control colors, it's got a lot of kill mechanics. So whatever is the most powerful kill mechanics exists in those colors is going to – it's not going to win out against if it's just not the best one.
But if you replace Surveil and said draw 4 cards when he comes into play. You know?
Yeah. So. Surveil
maybe.
4,
yeah.
Pretty gross.
All right, what's next?
I'm going to talk about a split card. I've got probably my favorite one and then the one that I think is likely the most powerful. What do we want to hear?
Both.
Both.
Okay. Yeah. I'll do my favorite one, and you're probably going to see a lot of this, but it is a head turner, that's for sure. Connive and Concoct. So this is a Dimir one. The first half is Connive, costs 2, and then Dimir Hybrid. You gain control of target creature with power 2 or less. Pretty solid effect. They've really reined in mind control, so, like, any effect that has that can be relevant. And then Concoct costs 3 blue black. You surveil 3, then return a creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield. So, in Dimir, where you're surveilling and probably putting creatures in the graveyard, this not only fuels you even more, but then gets one of those creatures back. I just really like that this card kind of does both things. Like, if there's something really troublesome, you can snag it from your opponent, or if you just need to bring back your fatty, you can do that as well. I was just excited about this card. It's got a lot of value behind it.
Yeah, definitely.
One thing of note for anybody that's curious, too, their take on split cards this time around, like, one half of their split cards are always all hybrid mana symbol, like, related, and the other half are exactly the 2-color guild combinations, so they keep playing around with their splits.
They did a really interesting article about the naming. It was either an article or a series of tweets about the naming, because this is the first time we haven't really had a X and Y naming convention. Yeah, exactly. It's not like a phrase. So it's actually based on, like, the first 3 letters of the card all match up.
Oh, okay.
Which they admitted, and that's probably why you realize some of the names are really awkward. Like, what is that word? What does it mean? Like, they really stretched for them, but it's kind of cool that they were able to make that all.
I literally never would have noticed that. Yeah. To mention that right now.
No, yeah. it's pretty intriguing.
All right, what's the most powerful one?
All right, so the most powerful one, or at least the one that I think is going to see the most play, is the one of the Boros ones, Integrity and Intervention. So Integrity is an instant that costs a single Boros hybrid mana. Target creature gets +2/+2 until end of turn. And then Intervention is 2 red and a white, an instant, deals 3 damage to any target, and you gain 3 life. So, again, this super flexible card. Like, if you need to save a creature, push through an extra 2 damage with a sneaky combat trick, it does that. When you want to finish off your opponent at the end of the game, get in 3 damage, or maybe even try to stabilize, you know, with 3 damage and 3 life, always swings the board state really interestingly, like, when your opponent's not expecting it. I just love the flexibility of this card. Obviously a little overcosted on the intervention side, as we've had Lightning Helix, but this is tacked on to another card and has another mode, so I think it's completely fine.
I believe Dragon's Maze also had Warrior's Heroes for exactly that same mana for 4/4.
Yep, exactly. So
the thing that the combat trick part, no one would ever play that card like in a constructed environment.
Right, exactly.
But you actually now put it in a constructed environment by just having it be half of this card.
Yep.
And maybe it actually gets used at some point instead of just like literally being a filler card in the set.
Plus,
and then for limited.
So. It's a red card, which triggers Runaway Steamkin. Just saying.
this card's solid. Matthew?
Better talk about the card that we just keep going around. The most powerful card, most likely, coming out the gate for the set is called Assassin's Trophy. I'm sure anyone that's even remotely read anything about the set so far has seen it. It's pretty straightforward. Black, green, instant, destroy anything at instant speed that you'd like, permanent, and their controller can search for a basic land and put it into play. Yikes. I mean, it is absurd, like, that this card is costed the same way that Abrupt Decay is.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spend a ton of time because I know there's a lot of people that have talked about this card, but yeah, this is great. It's worth, like, $40 right now, so it's also a pretty sweet card to open at the pre-release and, you know, find somebody
it'll
that needs
down.
It.
It'll
definitely come down, but yeah, it's the hot one. It's the chase card.
I mean, my only thought about this card at all is, we talk a lot about not in design, like not obsoleting old cards or whatever.
Yep.
And I mean, this one just feels really close to like.
It is very close. I mean,
it's a card. It feels a little bit like a card, and I don't mean this to be cynical because like this is a sweet card. I want to play with this card, right? It feels a little bit like a card that they knew in design would be an attractive, expensive card to get, you know, to put in the set. Does that make sense? You know,
when Abrupt Decay came out during the era it came out, I saw very little constructed play, or very little standard play, because like the cutoff for 3 CMC is a little bit rough. But in older formats, Abrupt Decay basically hits an entire format. This will likely see a considerable amount more constructed play in standard than Abrupt Decay did during its era.
Yes.
I guess the only other thing is, like, they've tried to be very conditional on removal, and this certainly is a condition. You get a basic land, which has consequences, but in general is, you know, kill anything. So I mean, the card's really good, and like you said, there isn't a need to talk about it at like great length.
Yeah,
right? So isn't there a reverse Yawgmoth's Will?
There is. It's blue and black and colorless, and then you exile your opponent's graveyard, and you can cast their spells, and I think you get to use mana of any color, but it's only until end of turn. So I don't know, like, Yogg's Will is also already pretty narrow, and you have to build your whole deck around it, and now you're just, like, banking on your opponent building their deck around it.
It's not great. It's funny, but
it's funny. It's an interesting card.
It's like the red Snapcaster Mage.
Yeah, exactly.
At the right point, you completely get them. But.
Well, and for me, when you go through the history of the game, like, I like it when they make a card like this just so that it exists. You know, it's out there, it's an option, there you go. But yeah, it's pretty mediocre probably.
Yeah.
So. All right, we got about 5 minutes left, so we can just speed it up or
sure.
So Kyle, you're up.
Gosh, I don't know. There's so many cool things to talk about. Let's see. I'm going to talk about Risk Factor, and not in the financial sense, but this is actually a card that they're printing in Magic, or in this set. It's 2 and a red for an instant. Target opponent may have risk factor, deal 4 damage to them. If that player doesn't, you draw 3 cards. And then it also has jumpstart. Browbeat effects, or, you know, this card is based on Browbeat. I think it does the exact same thing, except Browbeat did 5 damage. The fact that this is has jumpstart, meaning now you essentially have, you know, 8 copies in your deck, it makes that decision a lot more impactful. Typically, we say, you know, giving your opponent the choice is not to your advantage, but yep. At some point, like, you literally do browbeat them, you know, over the head. Like, you can't keep making the same decision. You're going to be forced into making one that's in my favor. It, you know, it's a fun card. It works great in this set, and I'm excited to try it out.
Matt, what do you got?
Thief of Sanity. It's a blue-black, one colorless 2/2 flyer. It is, they're paralleled, obviously, Night Vale Spectre, or not, mm-hmm. From the last time around to Ravnica. Interesting, because for the first half of that card's existence, it didn't do anything. In their half, it was completely busted. So Thief of Sanity is a flyer. If it ever hits your opponent, you look at the top 3 cards of the library, you can put one of them face down, put the other 2 in their graveyard, and for the rest of the game, you can cast it, I believe, like, using any mana color, I think, if I remember correctly. So all of it is actually better than Night Vale Spectre was during its era. So it'll be interesting to see which end of the coin we end up on for a card like this time around.
No, this card is awesome. I mean, the fact that you still get to cast it even after this card leaves the battlefield, like, that was a big downside to Night Vale Spectre. This is an awesome card. Like, if you can clear the way for it and start getting 2 or 3 cards, like, that's so much value.
Yeah, I'm in on this guy.
Yeah.
Kyle, you're up.
Let's talk about another value-packed creature, Beast Whisperer. This is 2GG for an Elf Druid. It's a 2/3, and whenever you cast a creature spell, you get to draw a card. I don't know. This is so much value. Like, if you can build a deck around a bunch of cheap creatures that just lets them keep coming, whether you're playing in Standard, we've got, like, Song of Frailes. We've seen that do stuff where you get 2 turns of turning all your creatures into Birds of Paradise. You know, you can really chain a lot of spells together off of that. Also, this is an elf, and, you know, modern elves is a thing. It's always tried to look after legacy elves, which had Glimpse of Nature. Now you have an elf with Glimpse of Nature built on. It might just be enough to, you know, put that into a new style or new win condition. So, really interesting card. It's also a throwback to a lot of cards we've seen before, which I think almost every card we've talked about here tonight, like, has a parallel to a previous card in Magic, and I think that's something that they really captured well in this set, is, like, there's so many cards that just give you that little bump extra or that nod back to a previous card that is going to make this a lot of fun. You know, similar to how Dominaria had a lot of those callbacks, they really hit it out of the park with Guilds of Ravnica as well. Just a random side note.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's a theme for the year.
Yep, exactly. Which is great on the 25th anniversary. Like, that's really what they wanted.
Yep. Matt, you're next.
I don't talk about red cards too often, but one that kind of amuses me intriguing is a card called Experimental Frenzy. It's a red 3 colorless enchantment. While it's in play, you can look at the top card of your library at any time you want. You can play the top card of your library whenever you want, but you can't play any cards from your hand any longer. But then, to make sure that you don't get completely screwed, you can spend 4 mana to destroy it. So it is interesting because we've seen, Khazad-dûm Kir, there was one of the sieges, was used, like, some for being able to play, basically, like, use cards off top of your deck. Yep. This thing effectively chains, so after you're out of steam, if you slam it down, you basically can just keep chaining it off top of your deck until you happen to finally hit 2 lands in a row. So sometimes these types of cards, like, bust out in a format in ways that, like, you know, people were not expecting them to.
I really appreciate that there's a card that, like, literally the effect is pay 4 mana, destroy this card that you previously played. Like,
all right, last cards, Kyle.
Oh, jeez, last ones.
Mine was terrible.
There's so many good ones. Hang on, I'm gonna find the best one.
While Kyle's hunting, remember the pre-release is September 29th and 30th. There are 6 events at Paradox beginning at midnight, Friday night/Saturday morning. And there'll be four single-player sealed decks, three of them on Saturday, one on Sunday, two at a Giant on Saturday night and Sunday night, all available for pre-order at ParadoxCNC.com, and the podcast can be found on our website also or on iTunes.
Dang, that was perfect timing, Rich. I just found my card.
Awesome.
So I'm going to talk about Cackling Drake, which is actually part of a cycle of uncommons. Every guild gets these that are costing AABB, which A being one color of your guild, B being the other. So Cackling Drake is the Izzet card, so it costs blue, blue, red, red. It is a flying drake. It's four toughness, and its power is equal to the total number of instants and sorcery cards you own in exile and in your graveyard. So this can get really big if you've got all those nice instants and sorceries. And then when it enters the battlefield, you get to draw a card. You know, this whole cycle is really awesome, and they really signify what the guilds want to do. So Cackling Drake is just my favorite because it is my favorite. So, but I'd love to, you know, talk about any of those, really.
Well, I love giving a sort of, almost signature card for the guild, right?
Yep,
by
exactly.
Going hard in the colors. So.
Yes.
Matt, you have the honor.
I'm not talking about this card, but Cormac Leonard says hello again. So that'll be a big deal. Mm-hmm. Being back. One other card intrigues me. They always do plays off things once in a while, like on other things. So they're making another take an extra turn effect card, like this time around. It's white, red, one colorless. It's instant speed, which I don't know for sure, but maybe one of the first times they've done that. It gives all of your creatures indestructible. You take an extra turn after this one, and then you lose the game at the end of that turn. So the fact that they've added a combat trick element into it makes it weirdly dynamic. Because you can set yourself up on your turn. You're attacking for a bunch of damage. They're doing their effect to blank you. Your creatures all survive. They're tapped out. You untap, and you just put them in the ground with your 4 or 5 mana open, and all your creatures still alive. So it's interesting to see them keep trying cards like this.
Yeah.
They're usually very hit or miss.
And that is not a typo. Your creatures gain indestructible is a continuous effect. It does not end at end of turn. Granted, you're ending the game that you're either winning or you're losing, but kind of cute.
I don't know if you can circumvent that somehow.
There are a couple of ways to do it.
It's gotta stifle it.
Yep, or use your the thing that ends the turn for you, whatever that artifact, There you go. Then all the creatures that you had on the battlefield are indestructible for the rest of the game.
Well, it's gonna be a fun pre-release, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Ravnica is so much fun. Multicolor sets are always great because you can do a lot of unique things. You get to identify with the guild that you want. Granted, sorry if you're one of the five that are coming next set.
They're
don't worry.
Jack Christopher.
You're going to get 3 months of yours. Just be patient. But, yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun.
He did get you a little bit on all the rage.
That's true. I used some improper wording in advertising the pre-release.
All right, everybody, thanks a lot. There's a lot more coming up. We're kind of overhauling everything about Magic the Gathering here at the store. I'd like to do a very specific podcast about all those changes as well, so hopefully we can get that done quickly. So just expect, we're going to have nightly Magic tournaments. We have added a prize wall. If those words don't mean anything to you, just hang tight. It will all make sense. And, of course, our 25th anniversary stuff where, the main tournament is a $2,500 total prize pool, including a trip for two, the Grand Prix of your choice in the domestic U.S. in the next year. Yes, you could go to Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
On us. And it'll be awesome. It's going to be Guilds of Ravnica sealed. That's why I'm kind of mentioning it here. So the pre-release is going to be a great chance. Even with the seeded packs, still be your big chance to play some limited before that weekend. So stay tuned. There are ads for that all over the place. Join the Facebook group, ParadoxCNC Magic. Check out the website, ParadoxCNC.com. You can go to Instagram at ParadoxCNC. You can go to Twitter at ParadoxCNC.
We're everywhere.
You can come to the store. There's nowhere you can't get it. So, not Pinterest. I guess.
Maybe someday.
We could have a Pinterest board.
We'll get on that.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you in the next Doxcast.
This was a Doxcast. Hope you think it rocks, cast. Oh, look at the clocks, cast. Until next time, geek on.